Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Van for Savant for September 8, 2024. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shepherd.
Good evening, sir.
All right, excited about tonight's show. One of our longtime favorite guests, David Neer, is coming on the show. We have had David when he was with Swing State Project. We've had David when he was with Daily Co's Election. And tonight, he's going to talk about his newest project. In a lot of ways, it's the same thing, but I'll let him describe it. But it's called The Down Ballot. That's how they're branding it. Now, we'll have David on to talk about that, in addition to talking about a lot of the elections down the ballot for the presidential race in 2024. But until then, we have got so many things to talk about because a lot of things have happened politically and socially that we just have to get to. And we're going to start off with something a little sad, something we've talked about too many times, but this time it was in Georgia, and there are some more personal connections for us as a radio show this evening. Appalachia High School in Winder, Georgia, they had a school shooting. At one point, I heard 30 people may have been hit. I think it ended up being 9 injured and 40 fatally shot. I guess it was Wednesday, 10:28 at school that day. It made the national news. I mean, tragically, these have become so frequent. We've become numb. This one did seem to kind of pierce the filter and get more attention, which I think that's what needs to happen to both honor the lives of these people and to hopefully affect change. But, Tim, I'm going to start off with you because I think of the three of us, you have the closest connection to the school.
Yeah, I did have someone that I'm related to who used to go to school there. I think we'd be as well off to just come up with a generic segment and record it here and just play it every time that one of these tragic shootings happen. It just happens so much, and we really run out of things to say, and I just don't if we don't start taking action, real genuine action, and we've talked about that, I just don't know what we're going to do. But these things get closer and closer to home for all of us and for you people listening. You probably, chances are now, you know someone that's been involved in a mass shooting in some way, because there are so many. There have literally been hundreds of them in the last few years. And it just breaks your heart when you know that things could be done that, well, our political folks don't have the will and the courage to do. I don't know what else to say. Help me out, Catherine.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tim. It's heartbreaking, and it's so frustrating. I was just shocked by, you know, this. I think he was 14. He got an AR-15 for Christmas, and I was thinking, okay, what did I get for Christmas when I was 14? I probably got some record albums and a camera or something. And then the other story that was very hard for me to read was about the, there was a classroom, the teacher left the classroom and got shot outside the door, and the student dragged her back into the room to try to take care of her. She did end up dying, but I just thought, you know, what courage those kids had to try to help her. And it's just the whole thing, it is heartbreaking and really angering. And then some of the reactions from some of the political figures have added even more frustration and anger. So, but you're right. I don't know what, you know, we just seem to be perfectly fine with this happening. I mean, not me, but as a country, we don't seem to be able to, like you said, have the courage or constitution to do something about it. And it's really sad.
Yeah. One of the teachers, the other teacher from the one you mentioned, he graduated from Ulm High School, which that was basically the high school Tim graduated along with the one on the east side of town that merged, became that high school. I was told later in the week by someone I work with that one of the teachers and coaches at Chattooga County High had just come from Appalachian High School. And so there were just a lot of ties in there. Catherine, you've alluded to it. I think that was one thing striking and sadly striking. J.D. Vance, senator from Ohio and wants to be vice president, as the Republican nominee, said school shootings are a fact of life. And honestly, if we're not going to do anything, he's right. But if you have the power to do something or try something, at this point, at least try something. Everybody, you know, 100 people come up with 100 solutions in the Senate. 435 people come up with 435 solutions. I'm sure some will be the same. Try one of them. If it doesn't work, try the next one. And try something, but don't say it's a fact of life. Because you know what? I can say, oh, it's not a fact of life I might get shot going to Walmart because Bullitt got shot in El Paso. It's a fact of life I could go to a concert because Bullitt shot out of a window at a concert in Las Vegas. And no telling how many times, and I'm the one that spends every day in a schoolroom for the past 31 years, that's a fact of life. Now, even this past weekend, you can't just drive up the interstate. That's a fact of life you may get shot at. They can't even find that person on I-75, the busiest interstate in America, shooting at people as they drive by. Tim, how outraged were you to be on brand when J.D. Vance made that comment?
Well, you know what? I'm sick of hearing stuff like that. I'm sick of hearing about people, you know, giving out thoughts and prayers and talking about the mental health of the shooter and violent video games and woke cultures and you know, just on and on and on. Look at what our governor did the other day, guys. He was asked a question by a reporter, you know, would this at last bring some legislative relief? Would something actually be done? And what's his stock answer? How many times have you heard this one, one of my personal favorites? Well, now's not the time to talk about it. He said,
right.
What we need to be doing instead is grieving for these folks and reaching out to their families and this and that. And the other, and of course, then, as we know, a few days passes by and never is the time. I'm sick of hearing stuff like that. And I'm sick of hearing from J.D. Vance, period.
Well, and the thing is if you leave time for grief and don't do anything, then you're never going to, I mean, they happen so frequently, you're never going to get anything done if you're, you know, I mean, they have to act. And I mean, even
yep.
if it's just as, I mean, something just as simple, or maybe not simple, but as obvious, is getting the AR-15s off the market.
They won't.
Let's just get rid. If the AR-15s were off the market, we'd be in
That's correct. That's correct.
I mean, I'd like to see a lot more than that, but let's just start there.
In the 10 years that assault weapons were banned, we had only one major mass shooting in this country, and that was Columbine, and that was it. And as soon as they let that ban lapse, what happened, guys? Boom. That's why I've said it on here before, and I'll repeat it again. Any talk about gun violence in this country without including the guns themselves in the discussion is pretty much pointless, ain't it, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where you're going to get. Now, of course, we had this discussion multiple years ago, and you know, the Republicans talked about mental health. There was a mental health that was going to fund mental health. The Republicans voted against it. It didn't pass because they didn't vote for it, because it would be spending money. It would be spending government money to give people a form of health care. So they're not for that either. So that kind of rings hollow, because they're like, oh, we must protect the guns, but we'll do anything else. If they would at least do anything else, if they're right and it's not the guns, then we'd know. But if it still continues on, even though there are robust mental health services, then we'd know it's the guns. It's kind of like science. You have to come up with possible hypotheses, and then you have to eliminate it until you come to the critical factor. We're not eliminating anything.
We're not doing a thing.
Our head in the sands. And that's
right.
The problem there. And so, we've talked about this so many times, and unfortunately, we'll probably have to talk about it again, you know, because we'll miss talking about, you know, 10 other incidents, because it won't have whatever connection, and we'll just be kind of, you know, emotionally numb to it, which is sad. So let's kind of move on to something else that happened this week, and something interesting at Duke University, and then I guess at a ranch in Texas. First, Liz Cheney announced that she was going to vote for Kamala Harris. I think she'd already kind of indicated she was going to vote for Joe Biden, but now, you know, after the ticket switch, she's going to vote for Kamala Harris. And then she said that her father was too. Then he even did a video saying how much he was against Donald Trump. And then additionally, and I guess she's not a Texas resident, not a Wyoming resident, she said she was going to endorse or support Colin Allred. So it's going beyond just the presidential ticket and Donald Trump. The way the chain, I wouldn't color any of the three of us as long-term big fans of the Cheneys, and certainly Dick Cheney. But how shocking and yet refreshing was it the Cheneys are going to vote for democracy and not for whatever Republican the Republican Party puts up?
Hmm.
A friend of mine posted somewhere, hell has frozen over. Dick Cheney's voting for Kamala Harris. You know, it's the whole, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, I mean, I'm glad for the vote. And I'm glad that he spoke out, but any other particularly progressive action from either of them. So,
yeah, Tim, I saw a picture. It was something on social media. It was a picture of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Dick Cheney. It said, "How big can this tent be?" I think there's actually members of the Congress that may be further left than her, but I got the point. How big can this tent get, you think?
Well, you know, we used to call Dick Cheney, if you guys remember, 20 years ago, Darth Vader.
Yeah.
That's how much we were opposed to Dick Cheney.
Go ahead, sorry.
Continue, please.
I always thought he was like the puppet master of the whole gang, right?
that's a good point. But, you know, what one thing we do know is that whatever he was for, we were generally against, and whatever we were for, he was generally against. But one thing I'm glad I never did with him is question his patriotism, because I'd have to eat my words on the air tonight if I did, because he stood up and did that. He put his country above his party. And I know that was particularly hard for him because he is a rock-rib conservative Republican, as conservative as it gets, but he's also a patriot, guys. Right, David?
Yes, I mean, this is somebody who worked for Gerald Ford. He was in the Congress from Wyoming, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, some of those western states have some Democratic roots, and, you know, I think we have Mark Johnson, and he'll talk about how there'll be this fellow from Montana or Idaho or wherever. But you really don't hear much from Wyoming. I mean, that is one state that if there's been some great Democrat, I've missed them. And then, of course, he was with George W. Bush as the vice president and all that time, in which I think we do get the sense that he kind of pushed a lot of that agenda, maybe even harder than George W. Bush at times. It is refreshing. It shows people can look at the bigger picture and how important democracy is. Now, they're kind of become Texans, even though both of them represented Wyoming. And we kind of talked about Texas a bit last week, mainly Florida. Is this a sign you think that Texas could possibly be trending even more Democratic? I believe it was a 4-point race last time. Could that close to where it's, you know, within a percentage point, Catherine?
Boy, wouldn't that be great? God, I would love that. You know, it's. I think, you know, we look at these polls and they're everything is so tight that it's just so hard to kind of predict what's going to happen. And, you know, you just cross your fingers that everything's going to go our way and hope that there's no, you know, forced errors or unforced errors. But it does look a little better in Texas than probably than it does in Florida, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to keep that. I mean, hopefully they're spending some money in Texas on the ground to get the vote out and make sure everybody is registered they don't have any crazy rules that we don't know about yet. But, you know, we'll have to keep our fingers crossed and keep working, and we'll have to see.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be a predictable march in Texas. It's just how fast is it and how much can an election like this move it? Tim, your thoughts on what could happen in Texas?
Well, I'll tell you what I think is going on right now is that there's been a surge there. Kamala Harris has cut Trump's lead in Texas in half. She's running in compilation polling, and I'm sitting here looking at it now, about a point and a half better than Colin Allred is.
Wow.
She actually is acting like the actual top of the ticket and helping the down ballot people. Right now, Cook Political Report does not list any competitive congressional districts, but there's one, you know, we've talked about a little bit on here. I believe it's 15, CD 15. We might want to watch that one and see if it comes into play as this race tightens. And I agree with Catherine. I believe we'd be better off spending our money in Texas this year than we would Florida.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have money to spend in both. And, of course, you've got to figure out how to win the presidency first and foremost. But those Senate races are big. Now, one that was notable if she is running ahead of Colin Allred, because in so many states, the Senate candidate is running ahead of the presidential ticket. That was true when Joe Biden was the nominee, and it's still true with Kamala Harris. So, which in some cases, that's fine. If she wins by three and the Senate nominee wins by seven, hey, as long as everybody wins, I don't have money riding on it. We want to go ahead and welcome now into the show our long-term favorite guest, David Neer. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you so much. I didn't know I was your longtime favorite guest.
Well, you've been one of our favorite guests for I don't know how many years now, and I think I said at the show, when you first came on the show, you were with Swing State Project, and then now for many years you've been with Daily Kos Elections, and now you've got a new project branding. I want you to identify it, start it, and tell us all about it, the down ballot.
Well, absolutely. That's amazing that I've been coming on your show since the Swing State Project days, and quite a testament to you folks that you've been around forever as well. Well, I'm super excited to tell folks about the down ballot. So we just launched a few weeks ago the entire Daily Kos Elections team. We left Daily Kos with the blessing of Daily Kos and Marcos, I should add, and to form our own site. And it's called the Down Ballot. You can find it at the-downballot.com. We are based on Substack, and we have moved to this new platform for a variety of reasons. But the chief one is that we are looking for a new source of sustainability. And we felt that because so many folks, including folks like you, have valued the work that we've done for so long, that moving to a reader-supported model was going to be our best option. And so we offer folks the ability to start a paid subscription at thedownballot.com. And I also want to be clear, though, we are relying on something more of the NPR model. We don't have any kind of paywall. If you want to read, it's free to do. If you want to comment, you're able to do that. But we're just asking folks to support the work that we do in covering all of these undercovered down ballot races to make sure that we can keep doing it for years to come.
Yes, and so I think some of the team came with you. I know Jeff Singer, who's also been on the Kudzu Vine many times for many years, came with you. Are there other team members that will be doing work?
Oh, yeah. So the entire team actually came with us, and it's a really remarkable story because most of these folks have been with us since the Swing State Project days, and the Swing State Project became Daily Kos Elections back in 2011. So we're talking more than 13 years ago. And now everyone is remaining on in some capacity or another as a contributor. It's an amazing team. And also, I should add, the community that we've cultivated since for 20 years has also really stuck with us. Folks are participating heavily both on our comment boards, and also we have a new chat server, a Discord server, that is a ton of fun.
Yes, and I saw that, you know, like a lot of folks are going to Substack. A lot of our guests have Substacks. What is really making Substack take off the way it has, particularly in the political realm?
I would say Substack is a platform that makes it very easy for either an individual content creator or a small group to start putting out a newsletter and sending it out by email and asking for paid subscriptions without really having to think about very much else. The platform is very, very easy to use, it just makes setup really quite simple. And yeah, I should also add, there is also a value in being in the same space as all these other political newsletters, because there are ways that you can interact between newsletters, between different sites on Substack. And so, you know, someone with their own Substack newsletter might recommend your newsletter. And so all of their readers get to see it, and then you can return the favor and vice versa. There's all kinds of network effects, shall we say, that are part and parcel of being on this platform. And, you know, obviously Substack, it's not perfect, and it's the company has come in for its share of criticism. I think some of it very valid. But in terms of the start that we've gotten off to, it's been awesome.
Yes. Well, now I'm going to get into some actual politics. I'm going to ask you about one state, and I'm going to leave the other 49 and everything else for Tim and Catherine. And the one I wanted to ask you about was Florida. Now, it'd be great to win Florida's electoral votes. The Senate race would be really nice for what's going on, but I'm hearing a lot about some congressional races. There's one in the Tampa Bay area. There's one in the Villages that's getting a lot, or I guess it incorporates the Villages. It's gotten a lot of attention. which ones of these congressional races in Florida are winnable races and which ones might just be like pipe dreams?
So the one that you mentioned in the St. Petersburg area, that's the 13th Congressional District. And I'm so glad that you wanted to get deep into the weeds right at the start, because this is where I thrive. So this is a district that is definitely quite unexpected to see that even Republicans are acknowledging that it might be competitive. This is the seat that was formerly held by Charlie Crist, who, of course, unsuccessfully ran for governor in the midterms. And Republicans heavily gerrymandered it to make it much easier for them to win. And, of course, they flipped it in 2022. They have a total far-right extremist representing that district, Anna Paulina Luna. And she also has just made up a lot of stuff about herself, kind of in the style of George Santos, even including pretending to be Jewish. A very, very strange woman. And what happened here was that an independent outfit, St. Pete Polls, which has been polling Florida for many, many years, produced a poll that showed the Democratic candidate a few points ahead. And this is in a district that Donald Trump won by several points and that Luna herself won by several points in 2022. And everyone was like, whoa, hold on. Is this an outlier poll? What's going on here? Does it actually mean anything? Then Luna herself touted a conservative poll that only had her up by 5 points. And she said something along the lines of, you know, this is what the state of the race really looks like. I'm paraphrasing there. But if even she is acknowledging that it's only a 5-point race in this gerrymandered district that Trump won by 8, then, you know, maybe there's something here. Look, she's still the favorite to win. But if Republicans have to start sweating House races in Florida that they really didn't think they would have to worry about, that's not a great sign for them.
Yes. Well, and I think if you can pick up a race in 7 or 8 different states, that flips the House. You don't necessarily have to have 5 races flip in California. You can't just bank on one state. You can get one in Alabama, one in Florida, one in another state or two. Well, so while we're in Florida, because we know that it's probably like the opposite of New York. The Republicans had control and they stretched the map to elect as many Republicans as possible. Probably means they have a lot of districts than in a more Democratic year, which anything could be a more Democratic year in Florida than probably 2022, would be more in play. Is there anywhere else besides that St. Pete, Tampa district to look at?
Yeah, you know, you raise an interesting question. There's always this fear that when you have the power to gerrymander a state, that you could wind up creating what folks call a dummymander. That is, you get greedy and you create a whole bunch of districts that maybe only went kind of narrowly for your party. And then in a wave year or a strong year for the other side, then things could go the other way. And yeah, I would keep an eye on Florida's 27th district. This is, again, another seat that the GOP gerrymandered. This one is in the Miami area. It's represented by Maria Elvira Salazar. And this one now went very, very narrowly for Trump by less than a point. That's definitely one that could potentially be in play. You know, I think the real issue is it's very rare to see a House seat flip without major outside groups on at least one side getting involved. It's hard to flip it if you're just a campaign on your own. You know, you really need the DCCC or the NRCC on one side or the other getting in. And so far, none of the major House groups like those have made any reservations for ad time in Florida, but they very well could. That could always change. You know, it seems like the election is awfully close now, but 2 months is still a long time. So keep an eye out, and certainly I will say that if any of the major outside groups, the real heavy spenders, come and start spending in Florida, you will find out about that first in our Morning Digest newsletter at the Down Ballot.
All right, that sounds great. Well, I'm going to pass it to Tim and then to Catherine for some more questions about Down Ballot races in every other state besides Florida. Tim?
Please.
Good evening, David. Thank you for being with us again. And yes, you have been around here a while. I just recall distinctly interviewing you back in 2008, 2009, along in there. So you You qualify as an old-timer, buddy.
So, I love that. I love that.
You mentioned, made passing reference, or perhaps David did, to California and New York. You know, we know the math. We need to pick up 5 House seats somewhere to flip control. And we recall the issues with both New York and California in those House races in 2022. But this year, the presidential election brings increased turnout, of course. Should we be in a good position to pick up several seats in each of those states?
You know, I have this very contrarian take on California and New York, and I agree with you. The fact that Democratic turnout was bad in the midterms in both of those states is good news for Democrats. And what I mean by that is exactly the point you were trying to make. It's very, very unlikely that in a presidential year, with the stakes being so high, that turnout among Democrats in those two big blue states is going to suck again. Because what we saw in those midterms was that in the states, the swing states where the stakes felt extremely high, states like Michigan and Arizona, we saw that Democratic turnout was quite good. But in the blue states, you know, folks figured, well, you know, is abortion really under threat? Is democracy really under threat? Maybe not. And a lot more folks stayed home. And it just seems impossible to imagine that that's going to happen this year. So if Republicans have to defend turf in California and New York, and of course they do, that's almost the worst possible place for them to be defending seats, because they're overextended. And maybe Democrats don't pick the House back up. Maybe it doesn't wind up being a great year for Democrats. But if it's an even decent year for Democrats, then those seats are, you know, going to be relatively low-hanging fruits.
Closer to our home down here, we've been keeping an eye on North Carolina over here in this gubernatorial race. And you know who I'm about to ask you about. That would be a gentleman by the name of Mark Robinson, who I affectionately refer to as North Carolina's Herschel Walker. is he so flawed a candidate that he is absolutely by himself going to cost the Republicans the governor's mansion in North Carolina?
You know, you call him the Herschel Walker of North Carolina. I almost think he might be the Doug Mastriano of North Carolina. And you know, as I'm sure Kudzu Vine listeners recall, Doug Mastriano was the extremist far right ultra MAGA candidate for governor of Pennsylvania in 2022. Wow. And boy, he got boat raced. I mean, Josh Shapiro absolutely crushed him by a really, really wide margin. And some folks who we've had on our own podcast, some folks from the Data Firm Catalyst, they talked about certain Republican candidates paying a MAGA tax, that the real extremists, that if you compare the sort of, I don't even want to call them mainstream, but if you compare, I guess, relatively normal Republicans versus the MAGA types, the MAGA extremists fared worse in the midterms. And Mastriano is the perfect example of that. And so if anyone is going to pay a MAGA tax again, if that winds up still being in effect, it's definitely Mark Robinson. I mean, I'm sure you folks saw that there was just some new audio revealed of him saying he wants to get down to 0 weeks for abortion. So yeah, and the real question is, I think, look, you can't take anything for granted. But to me, the real question is, right, does he hurt Republicans elsewhere on the ballot in North Carolina? And that's what Democrats really need to hope for.
Especially in the presidential race where, you know, if about 38,000 votes or so go the other way, hey, we're cooking with Sherry over there. Now I'm going to take you way to the other end of the country, because this is a candidate that you've talked about some. And I find her very interesting, Representative Petola up in Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it would seem that, I mean, it's Alaska, a very libertarian Republican type state. It would seem that she would be a huge target for defeat by the Republicans, a seat waiting to get picked up. And yet, well, they chose Nick Begich, who was clearly not their strongest candidate. Why did that unfold that way with the Republicans?
Boy, that is a really, really interesting question. And I, you know, Nick Begich got 28% of the vote in the primary, and the candidate that the, you know, D.C. establishment really liked, the lieutenant governor, she got 20%. So, you know, yeah, he ran ahead of her, but it wasn't a massive drubbing. The fact is he ran twice in 2022. He had more name recognition, and the Begich family is also one of Alaska's most well-known political families, even though everyone else in the family is a Democrat. So I suspect that probably just, you know, helped him kind of somewhat limp into the general election here. Republicans are definitely not going to give up on this seat. As you were alluding, it's Alaska. This is the reddest House seat held by a Democrat anywhere in the nation. And also, it's a super cheap state to advertise in. There's no other major races on the ballot. And it's, you know, the cost of running a TV ad in Alaska is very low. That said, Peltola got 51% in the primary. And we don't know yet whether Alaska primaries, this top four primary, whether they're indicative of general election results, because it just hasn't been around long enough. But 51%, man, I mean, in 2022, her share in the primary was much, much lower, and she still wound up winning. So if she can pull off a majority vote in November, just like she did in the primary, wow, I mean, you know, it's not a good sign for Republicans. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, really. I want to ask you one final question. This one's way out in the weeds, and then I'm going to send it over to Catherine, who I know has got a lot of other stuff to ask you. But now, like I mentioned to you, and like David mentioned to you, you've been with us a long time. You've through several political cycles, and you've done a lot of political writing over the years, and you've done a lot of interview type stuff, a lot of live political talk, doing your own podcast for a long time. So I got to ask you, which do you prefer? Do you prefer writing about politics, or do you prefer talking about it in mass media?
My answer is yes.
You know what? I'm gonna let you go with that.
Well,
I'm gonna let you off the hook.
I truly love it both. I really love it both because when you're writing, you get to really, you know, sit back and take your time and do all the research and you know, make sure you get all your ducks in a row and you discover things that maybe you didn't even think about and you get a chance to polish it. And, you know, that's a wonderful experience being able to inform people that way. But this kind of conversation, oh, it's so much fun, the back and forth, and you hear people's immediate reactions and someone says something and you're like, oh, yeah, but did you also think about this? And, you know, you build off each other. I think they're both essential. That's why we have our newsletter, The Morning Digest. That's why we have our podcast that comes out every Thursday morning. You know, some people like one, some like the other, and some like both. And I love it all.
Yeah. Just between me and you, I like both. And with that, I'm going to send it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Please. Hey, David. Thanks so much for being on tonight. And congratulations on the new project. I don't know if you remember this about me, but I am all about down ballot. I always remind people when they ask me, you know, how can I get involved, I always tell them to find a local candidate that they like, that they agree with, that they trust, and support them all the way as they move up a ladder or, you know, whatever. And that so much of what we are concerned about in our daily life is happening at the state and congressional level.
Yep.
I mean, presidents are important, senators are important, but for day-to-day stuff, look at your state and your municipality.
Yep.
So I'm so glad to hear you taking this up, and I haven't had a chance to look at the Substack, but I will now. I had lunch with a bunch of my friends this morning, a group of political people. There's about seven of us. We get together often. And one of the things that came up is, you know, we're old, so some of us have parents or aunts or uncles who are in, assisted living or old mm-hmm. people, old folks' homes or whatever. And one of my friends was saying that the place where her mother lives, there's a lot of people from other states who, like, moved here to be close to their families. And they're all confused about voting because we have so many different, like, you know, because they don't know how to use the voting machines here. They don't know, you know, what are their registration requirements. They have a staff member who's sort of in charge of it, but not really. And I've been thinking about all day. I've been thinking about all the different ways that we vote in this country. So, like, for instance, here we have, like, 3 weeks of early voting. I was looking up some state today that they have, where they have 7 days of early voting. Some have no early voting. Some have only mail-in ballots. Some have no early ballots and very strict absentee ballot rules. So how do we make sure that, like, it seems like a tangled mess. And what do you think is this, like, how are the campaigns handling this? Like, how do we make sure that we're not hitting everybody, like, after their early voting starts or before their early vote, you know, all these things? I mean, it used to be, like, it was that Tuesday in November. That was the only time you voted, and all the advertising, all the mail was focused on that day. But now it's all different.
Yeah, you know,
what are your thoughts about that?
This is one of the things that makes America America. It's so unusual, you know, in almost all our other countries, a national election is administered by some sort of national bureaucracy. We don't have that here for elections. All elections are run by 50 separate states, but really way more than that, because it's, elections are usually run at the county or municipal level. So we're
right.
talking about so many different approaches and systems and methods. What I think that there's a couple answers here. One is that campaigns are aware of this. And there are also lots of civic engagement groups that are also very aware of this. And so, they may or may not be able to reach everyone, but there are folks, very dedicated folks out there, who are looking to make sure that people who are, for instance, in nursing homes or assisted living facilities are properly registered, especially if they've moved from out of state and can get access to the polls, which can be quite difficult if you're infirm or your mobility is limited. So there are people trying to resolve this on a day-to-day basis. In terms of a broader approach, this is something that goes far beyond elections and really gets into the realm of legislation. And this is why Democrats in Congress have pushed a variety of voting rights reforms bills, including the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And these measures are so important because they really go toward not just protecting the right to vote, but also expanding the right to vote and making sure that states can't pull all kinds of voter suppression gimmicks and tricks that they love to use. And I think that if Democrats are able to somehow hold the Senate, which obviously is looking very tough, win the White House and win back the House, I think you're going to see a huge priority placed on passing some of these major voting rights bills, which really would go a long way toward addressing the sorts of problems you're identifying.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. So now that you mentioned the Senate, what are your biggest concerns about the Senate at this point?
And obviously, John Tester in Montana is facing the most difficult reelection campaign of any Senate Democrat, more so than Sherrod Brown in Ohio, simply because Montana is a redder state. You know, we got our first poll from high quality firms in quite some time from Montana just a few days ago, and it showed Tester down by about 8 points, and that was a pretty difficult result. If you're a Democrat, that was not something you really liked seeing. I got to caution, though, it's just one poll, and the race certainly isn't over yet, even if Republicans might appear to be favored at the moment. I think the real question Democrats have to ask is whether it makes sense at all to try to pursue a flip in Florida or Texas or both, because those are the only other states where Democrats have any realistic chance of offsetting a loss in Montana. On the other hand, You don't want to go after fool's gold and risk losing other states that are going to be very, very close and difficult, like Nevada, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, et cetera, because you went chasing much more difficult states like Florida and Texas. These are really, really difficult, major strategic decisions to make. And, you know, the folks at the DSCC and Senate Majority PAC, I am sure they are thinking very, very hard about what to do here right now, because it's not an easy choice to make.
Okay, and that brings me to another question. I think it was this week or last week we learned that the Harris campaign was giving, what was it, like $500,000 to the states, to down-ballot races in the states. Now, that's not, I mean, it sounds like a lot of money. It's not a ton of money, but, or was it $50 million?
It was $25 million.
$25 million. Oh, so do you think that I've been meaning to read up on whether that's, you know, how they're distributing it, though they'll probably never tell us. But do you think that's going to help us in states like Montana, Ohio, Texas, and Florida? I sort of feel like Florida. I mean, I know a lot. I feel like Florida's like that, like, boyfriend that you can't give up, you know, like we always want to try to win Texas and they always let us down. Not always, but mostly. I feel like it's time to move to Texas and get a little more headway there, but that's just me. Do you think that money will help? I mean, obviously it'll help, but do you think it'll be distributed in a way that would be helpful?
Yeah, so the campaign, the Harris campaign and the DNC were quite explicit in how they were distributing this $25 million, which I should note was the largest distribution, according to the Harris campaign, from a presidential campaign to races further down ballot. So they're giving $10 million each to the DSCC and the DCCC. Those are the Democrats' official campaign committees for the Senate and the House, respectively.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then smaller amounts to the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, which helps flip legislative seats, and the Democratic Attorneys General Association and the Democratic Governors Association. Collectively, they're getting about $5 million all told. You know, for a race like Montana, I really don't think in the end the money is going to be the make or break there. Both sides are going to be extremely, extremely flush. And also John Tester himself has been raising an extraordinary sums, just record-breaking, far more than he did for his last campaign. Where I think that the money from the Harris campaign and the DNC will probably wind up mattering more is for these further down ballot races that have much smaller budgets. You know, I always tell folks, you know, like you were saying about focusing on down ballot, you know, if you really want to get great bang for your buck, donate to a legislative race, because, you know, the budgets are tiny compared to the budget for a competitive House race even. And also, I think it signals an understanding from the Harris-Walz campaign of just how important it is for Democrats to fight at all levels of the ballot. Because I would say my biggest criticism of President Obama was that he really seemed to put himself apart on a campaign level from the rest of the ticket. You know, and the DNC withered, and I just feel like there was less of an interest in those down ballot races. Democrats paid a huge price. And I think Harris and Walz understand, especially Walz being a member of the House for so many years, look, we got to have a Democratic Congress and we got to have Democrats at other levels of government in order to have a chance to stop the MAGA brigades and their fascist attack on democracy.
Yeah, I agree. I adored President Obama, but I was disappointed when he shifted, created that whole OFA organization and sort of left everybody else to fight for themselves, like the state parties and the D-Trip. And so, I mean, he had his reasons. I'm not going to criticize him at all, but that was a disappointment. Are there any other state races that are really intriguing to you that we should be looking at more closely. I'm sure we'll find out about it on the down ballot, but give us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned to David when we were doing a little prep for the show that I am extremely interested in races for ballot measures, particularly regarding abortion, and also for state Supreme Courts. You know, the abortion ballot measures have gotten more attention than ever before, but the state Supreme Court races, you know, these have gained in stature, especially last year when we had the big flip in Wisconsin. But there are many other important state Supreme Court races this year in Ohio, in Michigan, in North Carolina, in Arizona, and in Montana. And these positions are so powerful. State Supreme Court justices wind up ruling on such a wide variety of cases, but especially things like voting rights, gerrymandering, abortion rights. And these are the kind of races also, again, you want to get great bang for your buck. Yeah, these are statewide campaigns, but wow, the budgets are much, much smaller than for a Senate race. You might only have a budget of $1 million, $2 million in a statewide race. Senate campaign, there might be $100 million in spending. So those are great opportunities for folks who want to get involved to focus on.
How does the, you know, I'm originally from Michigan, so how's the Michigan race? How are things looking in Michigan these days?
You know, Michigan is the of the states I mentioned. Michigan probably looks the strongest. Democrats took a 4-3 majority on the court there in 2020, and that wound up being huge because that state Supreme Court has issued all kinds of rulings in favor of voting rights and abortion rights, often divided very narrowly along those 4-3 grounds. You know, it's an interesting state because Republicans, if they sweep those races, they're two seats up, could take a 4-3 majority, or if Democrats sweep, they could take a 5-2 majority. And obviously Democrats would very much like to have a wider majority on the court. And, you know, I think that if Kamala Harris winds up winning Michigan, there's a good chance that the court will come along with her.
Yeah, I'm always proud to see how strong the Democratic Party has become there. Again, I mean, it used to be really strong back when we had more union members. any other hot tickets that you want to mention or things that we missed?
Well, you know, I hope folks saw that on Friday, late Friday night, a judge in Missouri ruled that an amendment to restore abortion rights could not appear on the ballot. Now, this is immediately appealed. It's going to be decided by the state Supreme Court very, very quickly because the state only has a few days left to finalize ballots. They got to get those printed and especially sent out to voters overseas. Here's something interesting, though. The judge, Chris Limbaugh, yeah, that name's not an accident. He is a cousin of the late Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh himself was from Missouri. Yeah, I'm just going to leave that there, but we'll have a resolution on that case very quickly.
Okay. David, I'm going to send it back to you. Thanks so much, David. So happy to have you on the show, and congratulations on the new project.
Thank you.
Yeah, when you mentioned the ballot initiatives, I was going to actually follow up and ask about Missouri, but I'm glad you talked about that since that is a kind of a wrench thrown into things. Well, just leave us this. We know it's the down ballot. We know it's on Substack. If there's anything you got to tell about how people can subscribe or benefits they get or whatever, feel free to do that. And also, if there's any big projects that are coming up, say, now, between now and Election Day that would make people even more interested, feel free to share that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give the website address one more time. It's the-downballot.com. You'll get subscriber information there. It's $7 a month or $60 a year. I mentioned our Discord server. A lot of folks may not be familiar with Discord, but it's basically a private chat room with multiple channels where people can talk about different topics. So we have channels for discussing the presidential race, for discussing down ballot races, for chatting about international elections. And so that is the number one benefit for paid subscribers. It's really a lot of fun. It's a great way to chat with fellow election nerds and also the entire team on the from the down ballot. All the contributors and staff, we're also on there. We're participating. It's great. It's very fast moving. In terms of big projects, yeah. So we have just started tracking. I was alluding to this earlier, but we've just started tracking the outside spending from the major groups that get involved in House races. And this information about their spending is really important because it tells us where the groups with the most money and the most polling think the competitive races are. Now, they're definitely never perfect. They always make mistakes. There are always races they miss in one direction or another, but they tend to get the House battlefield mostly correct. And so every week, every Tuesday, we issue a new update. So if you subscribe to the newsletter at the-downballot.com, you will get our big new update on all the major new House spending from the top groups. So you'll really be able to home in on what the House battlefield looks like.
Well, that all sounds great. And we'll continue to look at that as a prep for our show all the way through and beyond Election Day in November.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me back on Kudzu Vine, folks. I've always loved being on your show. And as I know I've said before, you really helped me get my start on radio. And you're a reason why we were able to start our own podcast. So it's just always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much for coming on. That's David Neer of the Down Ballot. So make sure you check that out. We've got just a few more minutes left in the show. And on Tuesday, a pretty big political event is coming up. Technically the second presidential debate of the 2024 cycle, but only one of the combatants will have been in the previous debate. This will be kind of a new look, a reset on ABC News. I guess it's going to be simulcast other places, but ABC News is going to host it between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. Catherine, what will you be looking for on Tuesday night?
Oh, jeez.
Well, you can look for Jesus, but I don't know that he's slated to debate.
I'm just looking for a strong presence from Vice President Harris with some juice to respond to any wild claims that former President Trump might make, and an ability to like challenge some of that without losing her patience and going off message so much. I know that's a big challenge, but I really think if the MCs or whatever you call them, the hosts, aren't going to challenge him on the facts, then we need to do it. So that's what I'm looking for.
Sure. Tim, same question. What will you be looking for in the debate on Tuesday night?
Well, first, the mics won't be hot when they're not speaking, so I'm going to see how the muted mics affect them. It actually seemed to help Trump in that first debate with President Biden. Secondly, is the vice president going to be bringing her A game? I'm going to be watching that closely because, number one, Donald Trump is a great counterpuncher. Number two, he has participated in more of these debates as a presidential nominee than any candidate in the history of this country. So he's well versed on what to do. Whether he'll do it is a thing. But the reason I want her to really bring her A game is I think she has much more to lose than he does here. I, as a matter of fact, I have a feeling if she loses this debate, it would probably halt any forward momentum that she had, and it could very well cost her, the election. She has to at least look to be his equal on that stage and maybe a little bit better. And then what I'm watching for with Trump, is he going to stay on script or is he going to get off of it? Because if he gets off of it, the fact checkers have nervous breakdowns. They're working so hard. And finally, there's always the once in a lifetime chance of a real zinger, you know, that everyone will remember. So those are the things I'm looking for.
How about you?
Yeah,
David?
I think that the zingers, a lot of times, that one little statement can be pulled out as a soundbite. It's kind of like the John Fetterman debate against Dr. Oz. John Fetterman didn't do well in that debate, but Dr. Oz really made a massive faux pas on abortion rights, and that became the thing. One I'm looking for is this past week, and it relates to the first debate, they asked Donald Trump about his child care policy, and he couldn't get into some testosterone off about who can, you know, walk longer on the golf course or any of that nonsense that we saw in the first debate. And because he avoided that question and never answered about his child care policy, they asked him about it. And it was the most incoherent, rambling, bumbling non-answer I've ever heard. And so one thing I think Kamala Harris needs to do is when he's asked a question about a policy and he wants to get into something else about, like, what inflation was on bacon 3 years ago, stick him back to that question. Put him back on giving, you know, real issue answers, because he has no depth about anything. When it talks about a three-point plan, details, he just can't do it. It's something that's not a Republican thing. There are Republicans that can give plans. J.D. Vance can probably give a three-point plan on something. It may be wrong, like have grandma watch them talking about your kids. But, I mean, at least, you know, it's not just incoherent. So, really, I think she'd be smart to do that. That's what I'm watching for, if she can force that. Well, next week, I'm sure we'll be talking about this debate, even though it'll have happened, you know, 5 days before. And also, for about the third time, we're having another great guest. Chuck Rocha has agreed to come on the show next week and talk to us about the political race. Chuck could talk about anything, but he is one of the smartest, like, two or three political experts right now on the Latino vote. And so Chuck, I'm sure, can really answer our questions in that form, as well as maybe some Texas, too, since that's his home state. So until then, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force?